the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again. Welcome to the show. Coming up, a former federal MP says a government should take over mouse baiting as it's getting serious. And authorities say stay away from mice, particularly in water, because they're just full of disease.
There are some very significant risks to having mouse carcasses, particularly in that kind of level in water tanks. The bodies of dead mice contain a lot of infectious diseases that can impact people, things like leptospirosis, that's a bacteria, as well as common bacteria like Salmonella, Campylobacter.
And we'd like to hear from you about the mouse situation. People say it's getting serious. Let us know if it's serious at your place. 0467 922 684. And we'll have more on the health issues shortly. But first up, former federal MP Tony Windsor is saying the mouse plague is so bad, the federal and state government should step in and pay for the chemicals and kill the mice themselves. He says it's a health issue and a farming issue, and the government should step in and not expect farmers who've had 3 years of drought to pay these huge sums of money for commercial baits that don't seem to be reducing the numbers enough. He said he's heard credible reports of several people being bitten by mice, and also reports of mice biting patients in hospitals in country towns, and as such it's a public health issue and the government must step in. He also says that the Ministers Littleproud and Minister Marshall should contact the APVMA and they should free up the use of chemicals to wipe out the mice before it's time to sow the crop and the numbers explode again.
Well, I think the time for talk, Michael, is probably over. There's been a lot of talk going on. You know, New South Wales farmers and others have been talking about this particular issue, but I've just spent a few days out at Coonamble and you know, the problem is rife out there. Enormous health problems developing, in my view. People, the homes, the businesses. You can hardly go into any business without smelling that there's been mice activity in there. So I think it's time that they really took this seriously and addressed it both at a state and a federal level.
So you're thinking that there's enough evidence, anecdotal evidence, that mice are around, they're biting people in, we're hearing reports of them, people being bitten, those sorts in their beds and things like that. So you think that there's enough of a concern that there's so many that something needs to be done at a government coordinated level?
Well, I've heard various reports from various communities out that way as to, you know, mice activities in two hospitals and in a nursing home, and others have heard the same, but I'm virtually certain that it has occurred in one hospital. I think it's pointless actually naming that hospital because they're not to blame. The issue is a massive mice plague happening, and as it starts to cool down and we get a bit of wet weather, those mice are going to go hunting for food. Well, they're in everybody's homes and in everybody's businesses, so they would quite naturally be in hospitals and aged care premises. But I think it really broadens the issue away from what a farmer's going to do about their crops. And that is a critical issue because there's enormous expenses involved. But what are we actually going to do about the plague spreading where controlled activities aren't taking place? And I think that's a health issue where the Department of Health at both levels needs to intervene and start to show some activity rather than just some advisory signs on poles saying do this, do that, and good luck. These towns are really starting to suffer in terms of the health implications, and they'll only get worse as the winter approaches.
Now, the other issue is too that farmers, and quite a number of farmers, have spent thousands and thousands of dollars, and it doesn't seem to be reducing the numbers at all. So coordinated, and there's a reluctance, there seems to be a bit of, red tape and shuffling of blame between the state and the federal government about who should maybe pick up a tab for something like this.
Well, I think government, like the farming community, like most people who are living in the middle of this mouse plague, are hoping that something's going to happen. And that may well be the case. They may get a lot of rain and they all get drowned or they contract a disease and all die. But It's not happening at the moment, and I think, you know, particularly agriculture and health are beholden to actually start addressing this in a serious way. And if that means, you know, fast-forwarding some of the approval processes in relation to control, or I think personally it's going to need an injection of funds to stop the plague from moving into other areas. We know it. We know where it is. We know what to do. Let's get in there and do it in a coordinated fashion, so that the farmers that are doing something don't get invaded by the people next door that aren't. And particularly coming into planting season, we're going to have all sorts of issues out there. So there's some real economic ramifications, health ramifications, etc., that are starting to raise their head. And I listened to New South Wales Farmers, the president, yesterday on your program, and it was all very interesting to have people talking to one another, but I think the time for action's probably past, and let's get on and do it, within the next week.
So you think maybe a coordinated health and agriculture, maybe, setting up, baiting programs and maybe LLS and so that treated grain, and really ramping up what's out there at the moment in terms of control measures?
Well, it can be done. It's been done in the past. Yeah, this is a natural disaster that's happening. When locusts get into plague proportions, there's a coordinated approach to controlling it, not just to help the people that happen to have the locusts in their back paddock, it's to help the people who haven't, and to stop them from spreading and the economic damage that comes from all of that. So I think, we've all sat on the fence a bit on this and sort of hoped that the mice would go away. Well, it doesn't seem as though they are. Hopefully they will. But I think we've got to start and do something to help them leave the premises.
Yes, talking about that issue, I've contacted the Minister Littleproud's office for comment. They suggested I contact APVMA, and they've got back to me, but they haven't provided me with the details of the latest requests on chemicals. I've also contacted Adam Marshall's office again to see if there's any news on that from today's meeting with farmers. Still haven't heard back on those details yet, so we'll wait and see, but the calls are out there at the moment. It's 12 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. And we've got a text in, someone's texted in, where are the best laid plans of mice and men? Good question, whoever that is, that's the person that's texted in. Well, while farmers are doing what they can to try and limit the devastation being caused by the mouse plague across parts of the state, we're being warned about the health risks increasingly of coming into contact with those rodents. Mice are being found throughout farms, including in hay, crops and water tanks. Priscilla Stanley is a Director of Public Health with Western Local Health District.
They're dirty little creatures, and there are some diseases that can spread from the rodents to humans, so they're otherwise known as zoonotic diseases. And the one disease that we are particularly concerned about with the increase in mice numbers is it's called leptospirosis. So it's a disease that can spread from the mouse to other animals and then to humans, so either from the mouse itself and their droppings and urine, or the other animals as well. So that's just one of the diseases that humans can get that we see increases because of the mouse numbers, but there are other diseases as well there that can impact humans and their health. We, in the early stages, we were actually quite concerned about human health when we found out people were using baits in their homes that were intended for agricultural use. So this mouse plague has created a number of issues that we're struggling with, and I know people in the community are really struggling as well.
What sort of symptoms are associated with the likes of leptospirosis?
Yeah, and this is where it gets really tricky, because often people will just feel a little bit unwell, and it can be confused for just a common cold or influenza. So sometimes people will not visit a GP and battle on, but it can progress, and especially with leptospirosis, it can develop. People can develop really serious disease. It is something that people that have had it describe a very, very unpleasant experience. So it sometimes can present very similar to what we've talked before about Q fever. And there is also another zoonotic disease called brucellosis. And they all can present with very similar symptoms of those headaches and muscle aches and pains. One thing with lepto, though, people describe sore red eyes. That's another symptom. But I would encourage anyone who is experiencing the increased mouse numbers and they do become unwell, please visit your GP. And when you are describing any of your symptoms, you may have also explain the mouse numbers and what you may be experiencing in your home.
Have there been any incidences of leptospirosis or any diseases sort of associated with the mouse numbers?
We've been really pleasantly surprised, I suppose, at this stage that we haven't seen any increased numbers of leptospirosis. We have had another disease that it's got a nice, big, long, complicated name that we have seen, and that is linked to the mice, but it's very rare. And so it caused the person who experienced this illness, they presented with headaches to their local hospital, and those headaches increased in severity, and they were diagnosed with the abbreviated version as LCM. So it's and it was a viral infection. So the leptospirosis is a bacterial infection, so just the differences there. But whatever the case, these pesky rodents are have the ability to spread disease, and it's we just encourage people to do the best they can in controlling those their risk to these diseases.
That's Priscilla Stanley from the Western Local Health District talking there to Joanna Woodburn. Now, we've actually had confirmation this morning from New South Wales Health. I'll just read you the details here. New South Wales Health has confirmed that hospital patients have been bitten by mice as the plague continues to cause havoc in Western New South Wales. So that's been confirmed from New South Wales Health today. And also on the issue of health and the mice situation, mouse plague, Dr. Andrew Peters, Associate Professor in the School of Wildlife at Charles Sturt University, is warning about the particular concerns that have been raised about mice and dead mice in water.
There are some very significant risks to having mouse carcasses, particularly in that kind of level in water tanks. The bodies of dead mice contain a lot of infectious diseases that can impact people, things like leptospirosis, that's a bacteria, as well as common bacteria like Salmonella, Campylobacter. There are some viruses as well that mice can carry that can persist in water tanks for some time, actually. And these are a significant risk to human health. And in fact, any water tank that is going to be used for water for human consumption, or in fact any kind of use that involves close contact with people, so that could be, for instance, hosing down yards, using as sprinklers in gardens. If there is contamination of that water with particularly carcasses, but also more broadly other biological materials like urine or feces from wildlife, including mice, that is a significant health risk, and the appropriate action should be taken to address that. And those kinds of actions include through council, so contacting your council about that, chlorination. There are some other kinds of UV treatment, etc., filtration that are effective. But it's really important to make sure that experts in water quality management are contacted. But it's certainly not something that you would ignore. It is a really significant health risk if that water is going to have any contact with not just people, but also domestic animals.
So, Dr. Peters, this isn't just about ingesting it. You're saying that just sort of, as you said, hosing down yards can be problematic as well.
That's right. I mean, the real issue here is that, we tend to associate the risks in water with ingestion. And indeed, the most severe and common risks are through drinking water that's untreated. But there are a number of diseases that, if they are aerosolized, that means if they come up as a spray, and they're inhaled, they can cause disease in both people and in domestic animals. And certainly, you think about something like hosing down dairy yards or other kinds of yards where you've got high-pressure hoses and also other kinds of spraying. We know that people are affected sometimes with contaminated water that's used in sprinklers, and you'll have kids playing in those sprinklers on a hot day. There are a number of cases of public health risks associated with that kind of water usage, where the water is of inadequate quality and it has infectious organisms in it.
Dr. Andrew Peters is Associate Professor in the School of Wildlife Health and Pathology at Animal and Veterinary Sciences at Charles Sturt University. Got a few texts in. Someone's texted in saying, and they carry fleas, these mice, and they also carry diseases. Someone's texted in as well, when it comes to the mice plagues or mouse plagues, I think is the correct usage, the gnats and libs are asleep at the wheel. Mick at Deniliquin says RLPB and LHPA, the old boards, did provide mice baits to households in the past, but he says LLS staff now are not able to mix bait and they're not trained in mouse control. And another text has come in saying, why aren't the local and regional emergency management committees engaging in this issue? It seems to fit the definition of an emergency requiring a significant and coordinated response, which is sort of what Tony Windsor was saying earlier on in the program. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And keep sending your texts in, 0467 922 684. Well, the vaccine rollout for COVID for meat workers has begun in Victoria, where they've had several outbreaks in abattoirs. A number of workers have had the shot, but the industry is looking at large-scale vaccinations on work sites to try and speed things up. Patrick Hutchinson is the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council. He told David Claughton the criteria for who can get the vaccine is broader than expected, and there's quite a bit of work to be done to figure out how to do it efficiently.
We are still working on a state-by-state basis. We know that there has been some initial rollouts in Victoria on a site-by-site basis, but that's been very preliminary. Other than that, I think now we're just working through a process of working alongside the different state departments with our members, trying to ensure that we can look at the different strategies that we can put in, such as either a group of workers going at one time or on-site vaccinations or you know, different combinations.
How's it been handled in Victoria so far?
Look, we only are just trying to find some intel now. From what I understand, you know, it's a pretty, it's been, you know, certain groups are volunteering to provide the vaccine in regional areas. So I think there's only been a handful of people starting to move through that system, and they're just getting vaccinated and moving on like anyone else that's been vaccinated thus far in the community. So, yeah, we're just sort of trying to see, you know, is that going to work for us, or do, more importantly, do we need to try and tackle things like on-site vaccinations, have a big hit in one go? So,
how big's the job? How many workers need to be vaccinated?
Well, I mean, that's going to be the interesting part, because we've been able to find out clearly from you know, the different departments out there what actually constitutes a meat processing worker. That's been a little difficult for us to try and understand in the past. So now we know that a meat industry worker, as far as the federal department is concerned, is an abattoir worker. That also includes on-plant veterinarians, bunning room workers, small goods manufacturers, cold chain transportation workers, and it also means and it also covers seafood processors as well.
Wow! So it's quite a big number, 50,000 or 60,000 at least. Yeah.
Correct. So when you look at small goods manufacturing at certain sites where there could be up to 1,000 people in certain areas, some processing facilities can be red meat processing facilities can be between 500 to 1,000 people or more in certain states, and then you take into consideration some of the cold chain transportation workers as well, yeah, you're starting to really, you are starting to get up there. So, again, as I said, you know, different states have got different ways they'd like to do this or are offering different services or solutions. We're just, as an industry or as an industry body, David, what we're doing is providing the necessary guidance for our members. But essentially, it's going to be up to each individual member how they engage with their health, that state's health department, and in turn how that health department would engage with, certainly on a regional basis, GPs and the like that are offering the services.
And how are workers feeling, do you think? Because there were some outbreaks in Victorian abattoirs. Are they anxious or are they concerned? Does everybody want to get vaccinated or are there concerns about the vaccinations?
Well, we've you know, it's obviously on the public record that that the National Cabinet is in no way in any areas mandating vaccinations for any workplace, and we even saw that within aged care.
So you don't need to get a vaccination if you're a meat worker necessarily?
No. What we're saying is that what we're putting forward is that obviously what we saw in Victoria is that if the community management of the virus is not undertaken exceptionally well, then in fact the opportunity in a meat processing facility where you've got cooler temperatures and you've got people working closer together ensures that the virus can take hold. And that's what we saw in 6 different establishments for meat processing and 3 different establishments for smallholders manufacturing. That's what we saw occur. So we didn't see
so the employer might actually say everybody's got to get vaccinated if you want to work here?
Look, there's potential for that to happen. There's potential for workers, obviously workers are voluntarily looking at tackling that as an issue themselves. Overall, we are just encouraging all people who are there and working on site that this is a great opportunity to get the vaccine, especially for yourself and your family. I've not heard any one company say no jab, no job, but certainly... our role and what AMIC is out there telling meat workers is we really encourage you to get vaccinated because you've got the opportunity more than most other workers in the community of Australia to get vaccinated first. That's a very, very good opportunity and you should be taking it.
That's Patrick Hutchinson, the CEO of the Australian Meat Industry Council. Just got a text in. This is pretty interesting information that Adam Marshall actually cancelled the meeting today with New South Wales farmers, and we're hearing that he cancelled that meeting after hearing all the media around mice yesterday. So that is an interesting development because we were following up on that meeting to see what came out of it, but obviously it's been cancelled by the minister. But we need to find out whether that's actually true or not. We're just getting a text in from someone who says they have knowledge of that. It's 28 minutes past 12. Well, let's turn our attention to worker shortages now. That's another issue that's on the table for ministers around Australia. The National Peak Citrus Industry Body says it needs thousands of seasonal workers to get this year's crop picked in time. Citrus Australia is calling on state governments to increase their hotel quarantine cap for seasonal workers from low-risk countries to fill that labour gap. CEO Nathan Hancock says so far 2,600 workers from the Pacific Islands have arrived in Australia, but only a small number will actually be picking citrus fruit.
Over the period of our harvest, starting from probably within the next 2 or 3 weeks in Queensland through to the end of the year around, say, October, down in the regions around the Riverland and the Riverina, we're going to need probably around 30,000 people across that time, not all at one time, but the cumulative number of people that are working in citrus across that period. We tend to find that people don't stay in the roles for a long time because they tend to have very short windows of opportunity for the harvest and then they need to move on. So those people need to be available in the thousands, not 30,000 all at once, but in the thousands, and then be able to work across a range of different locations. We've been able to bring in, I think it's 2,600 workers over the last few months without any COVID prior to boarding, during their quarantine or since. And that's a really great strike rate, and we want to keep that safe environment ongoing. But we're very concerned that the number of people that are coming in is so small when such large numbers of people have left the country that would normally do this work, and we can't attract Australians to do it. Minister Littleproud said many months ago that there's 20,000 people in the Pacific Islands that are stood up and ready to go, and we need to get access to them the quickest way to do that is to put resources into the hotel quarantine space across all the different states, increase those numbers and bring more people in as quickly as we possibly can.
Now, certain state governments have developed schemes to bring in workers from the Pacific Islands. How successful have they been at this stage? As you've mentioned there, so far they brought in 2,600 workers, but do they all go to the citrus industry?
No, very few have gone to the citrus industry so far. This is the difficult thing by the federal government basically handing quarantine responsibility back to the states. It's created multiple different pathways and they're all very different from each other and they've all gone in different paces. Queensland very quickly got out of the blocks and created an on-farm quarantine, which has worked to a degree and has certainly brought in some workers that will work in citrus and they've worked in table grapes before that. And that pathway remains open and we're not saying to remove that or we're not saying to alter that in any way. We're saying it would complement the work they're doing by increasing the number of beds in Queensland so that smaller employers who can't meet the requirements under the on-farm quarantine could do that. Other states such as South Australia have got a quarantine pathway that they've developed, which is going to use a regional facility. We have our concerns around the cost of that, but largely we're very pleased that that quarantine program has been set up. Before that, the quarantine program in South Australia was meant to be through the Medi hotels, and unfortunately, there just wasn't enough resource put to that, and we saw that fall short, and that's held up the progress in getting seasonal workers into the state. Now, we would still see that there would be opportunity for smaller employers to use Medi hotels in South Australia if there were more beds. Other states like Victoria have taken the long way around going through Tasmania, but at least there are numbers coming through in reasonably large numbers are planned over the next few months. And in New South Wales, we're seeing that area is very slow in uptake because the costs are $3,000 per worker and simply too high. Unfortunately, many growers out there aren't aware really of the difficulty of getting workers, and they're going to find that out at the very last minute when they simply can't find them.
The chair of Citrus SA, Mark Dakey, has been calling for a travel bubble with the Pacific Islands. Is that an idea that you would support as well?
The travel bubble is problematic in that it's very difficult for the Australian government to green light Pacific Islands because of the ability to put enough health workers in and make sure that their systems are working. I think that's probably something that we could build over time, and the announcement by the South Australian government that they're interested in the onshore quarantining in country I think is positive, but that's a longer term thing.
How much of the national citrus crop is at risk of not getting picked this year?
That's really hard to put a number on. I think there's a chance that there will be a loss. I can't say what that will be. It's too early to say.
Citrus Australia CEO Nathan Hancock speaking there to Jessica Schremer. You're listening to The Country Hour, 28 minutes to one. Quite a few texts coming through. We'll get to them shortly, but before we do that, let's get some news headlines now from Rani Hayman. Good afternoon.
Thanks, Michael. The New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says she's not surprised people have had issues trying to book in to get a COVID vaccine at GP clinics. GPs say they were swamped and caught by surprise yesterday after older Australians were encouraged by the federal government to get a jab. A proposal by one of Australia's top police officers to use phone apps to record sexual consent has been branded naive. The New South Wales Police Commissioner, Mick Fuller, is proposing a mobile app could be used to register consent between sexual partners. The Weather Bureau has issued a flood warning for the New South Wales mid-north coast, Hunter region and parts of Sydney. Some areas have already recorded more than 100 millimetres of rain as a coastal trough begins to intensify. And New South Wales has recorded zero new local coronavirus cases in the latest reporting period. More news at 1 o'clock.
So some good news for a change.
That's right.
Thanks for that, Rani. Rani Hayman there with the news headlines. Let's find out what's happening with we're talking about the weather there and some warnings around the place. Jordan Notaro, some flooding maybe on the way, some wild weather at the moment, mainly confined to the coast.
Yeah, definitely at the moment we are in a heightened period for coastal areas where we've already seen impacts of heavy rainfall around parts of the coastline of Hunter and Mid-North Coast this morning, seeing areas of flash flooding for those regions. we've already seen since 9 a.m. already 100 millimetres of a couple of gauges around Kempsey and all the way up towards parts of the mid-north coast near Port Macquarie. But rainfall 2.9 this morning also was quite significant. Obviously, through inland areas, we had an upper level low developing with some pretty steady rainfall. We saw about 100 millimetres falling in some of our gauges around at the areas of Dubbo. So Dubbo got 65 mils to 9 a.m. and up towards Canamble, we got near towards 90 mil. Those coastal areas, as I said, got more to 9 a.m. this morning, getting well over 100 millimetres, 150 mils is the max to 9 a.m. this morning. So we're really in a quite seriously wet period for mainly the whole state as we've been pushing across with those severe weather warnings for damaging winds and heavy rainfall. Flood watches current across the parts of the mid-north coast down towards areas of Sydney. And as we move into the next few days, storms also being the wild card for particularly heavy rainfall, which may again produce some quite serious flash flooding areas of the coastline.
For the coastline, what about the inland?
Inland is seeing its own system. So as we move towards Monday next week, we have a trough that is pushing through from the west, and that is looking like it's going to give a broad inch of rainfall through the entire interior of the state, with likely pockets of well and truly double to triple that as well through areas, particularly through areas around the northwestern parts, which generally are not normally getting quite this kind of intense rainfall in this time of year. So it's going to be quite a widespread event as we move towards this next period for Monday onwards. And our models are suggesting, as I say, quite a good chance of getting quite widespread inch rainfall across the state. But particularly the risk is that we may be seeing actually too much for some areas, and they may get some potential isolation for those areas that may get, again, potentially up to 100 millimetres falling over a 24-hour period. So at this stage, really the messaging really is for one of keeping, considerably alert on what the forecasts are coming out with as we move towards the next couple of days. While the focus is on the coast at the moment, there is definitely a chance we'll be looking at potential warnings for areas in the west of the state for those potential heavier rainfall totals as we move into the new week.
Yeah, we're already hearing reports, as I was just saying to you before, at 94 millimetres at Warren, and that's what we're reporting from John. He's texted in. And also Greg at Ningen says he's... it's raining there. It's been raining for some time. He's got all his tanks are full of water. So it's obviously been raining in those parts as well. Maybe they've just been under a storm.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a combination. We've had this upper level low. If you ever have anyone gets a chance to have a look at the BOM satellite imagery, it's quite easily definable through those inland areas where we have this low pressure upper system there. Those quite consistent rainfall totals associated with that system, and again, the wild card of some storms, have been producing those rainfall totals to 9 a.m. this morning. But really, as we move into the next period with this trough coming across, it's going to be more of the same, widespread, very likely to see good amounts of rainfall. It's kind of a time where we want to be taking sort of precautions of getting how people are going to actually move around over this new week for, again, potentially some of those rainfall rates, which may be not something that we have been seeing for a while.
Right, and it's going to continue for the next few days?
Yeah, so broadly, the likelihood of having those higher rainfall totals comes from Monday onwards. For coastal areas, definitely a short-term period. But for those areas inland, it is going to be lasting as we go into the mid part of the week, stretching from the far west from Monday, more around to the ranges as we get towards Thursday, Friday. And those coastal areas, again, may see a recurring of some more heavy rainfall as we go towards the later part of next week as well. And that's going to be on top of all the rain that we are forecasting in the shorter term as well.
Okay, well, I'll let you get back to it because I understand it's a very busy day there in the Bureau at the moment.
That's right. Thank you, Michael.
Jordan Nataro at the Bureau there, 22 minutes to 1.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
We're talking about the rain, and while many in the pastoral zone and in western New South Wales and some of the cropping zones in the New England and northwest that have missed out in recent months, they're glad to see it raining, of course, but elsewhere in the state, many farmers would like to see a bit of a break from the rain, because rain at the moment is damaging blueberries, blackberries and raspberries. Stephen Thandy is a blueberry grower at Woolgoolga.
Michael, I just got back from the farm this morning. There was 55 mil overnight. I think it's just around the 200 mil for the month so far.
And that's probably not ideal for you at this time.
No, it's not. The blueberries are just starting to flower and the bees just don't want to go and start pollinating. But also our blackberry growers and raspberry growers who grow under protected cropping, the bees aren't going in there to pollinate their crops.
And this is a crucial time of the year?
It is. We need the pollination there to have a good crop.
And that's, of course, for the whole, your next sort of 6 months or so. So your program is really, put in jeopardy a bit.
Yeah, well, the blueberries will keep flowering, so which won't be, in the long term, it won't be that bad. But the raspberry and blackberry guys really need that pollination in there now.
So you'd like it to stop raining, you know, heaven forbid, because we've just been through 3 years of drought. But at the moment, you need some respite to get the business back up and running.
Oh, definitely. Look, we need the rain to go away for at least a couple of weeks. The ground can dry out. We can get out there and slash the properties again, get the grass down, and, yeah, get a bit of firm footing out there.
And you wouldn't be the only one in that region that's concerned about this?
All the blueberry and raspberry and blackberry growers are very concerned in the region.
Stephen Thandy's a blueberry grower. He's also chair of the Oz Group Cooperative. 20 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Got a few texts coming through on the rain. No rain on the southwest slopes in the Riverina at the moment. Cyril at Ralston's texted in saying, unfortunately, another example in regards to the mice of the government being asleep at the wheel. He says he's surprised that they haven't come up with a committee to train some Pied Pipers out there, and they would do that using our job seeker taxes, says Cyril. And Tony from Lake Heights said it was good to hear Tony Windsor's voice again, and said that he's sadly missed from politics over the last little while and in Parliament. And Scooter has texted in from Goulburn. He's saying this. He hasn't seen a mouse at Goulburn for about 12 months, so he's just letting us know where there are mice and where there are not. I guess it's 19 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country. Well, let's turn our attention to the wool industry now, and wool growers will have the opportunity to vote on a 10-year term limit for directors for the grower-funded Australian Wool Innovation. It's something that was called for in an Ernst & Young inquiry. Also, the Minister Littleproud has been calling for that as well. Now, if the motion is successful at the AGM later this year, it will also see current chair Colette Garnsey retire after joining the board in 2011. AWI CEO Stuart McCulloch told our reporter Josh Becker it will help address grower concerns about board term limits.
What they've announced today is a decision that was made in the early March board meeting that they had here to put a motion up to the 2021 AGM in support of a 10-year tenure of directors. And this dates back to the review of performance 2018, where it was clearly a recommendation and one of only two that's outstanding at the moment. What we were asked to do is prosecute this with the industry, and we did that by way of the Wool Grower Industry Consultative Panel, and have been doing that for 2.5 years with them. And even though pretty much every meeting over the last 2.5 years this was a topic, there was no clear path identified by the Wool Industry Consultative Panel, and the board felt that given that there's another review of performance coming up, that this be resolved by way of putting it to the shareholders.
So this motion for a 10-year limit on the director terms of the AWI board, will the AWI chair be backing this plan?
It's a decision of the board to support it, so the whole board support it. She is a member of the board, so yes.
And so her proxy votes will be directed to support that motion?
Her proxy votes will be supporting that motion.
What impact will that have on the role of the chairman, Colette Garnsey?
Well, what it means is, by way of rotation, Colette happens to come up at this year, at the 2021 AGM, and that means that she will have to go. The other director that it affects is David Webster, who's over the 10-year mark, but was re-elected in 2019, so his rotation comes up 2023, where he will resign at that meeting.
And what will this mean for board members or for directors that have served a considerable term on the AWI board in the past. Is it 10 years in a cumulative sense, or is it 10 years in a row? How will that be working?
Well, typically they serve it in a row. We haven't had, to my recollection, in the time of AWI, actually, that's for 21 years, we haven't had any directors that were on the board and then went off the board and then came back on the board. I can't remember an instance of that. So at the moment, that's not going to affect this particular board.
So is there a foreseeable case that while Merriman, who's been chairman of AWI for many years in the past, could run to be elected this year and then serve a further 10-year appointment onto the board pending subsequent re-elections?
I'd have to look at that. I don't know, as I said, any instance where someone was on and then off and then came back on, and we'd probably want to seek some legal counsel on that and how that would take effect.
What will be the requirements for this proposal to pass?
Well, like any constitutional change, it requires a 75% or more vote for it to be passed, which is corporations law. So the motion is put up by the board. The motion is supported by the board. But it's really the shareholders that have the say here, and that's the appropriate way to solve this particular outstanding review of performance item.
That's AWI CEO Stuart McCulloch ending that report from Josh Becker. It's 1:45.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, dairy farmers in New South Wales say they're operating under the best seasonal conditions in years and milk production is up across the state. Dairy Australia has released its latest situation and outlook report with good news, particularly on input costs. However, farmers are still leaving the industry facing pressure from beef and sheep enterprises. For an overview, let's hear from Dairy Australia senior analyst Sophia Olmsted.
We're actually experiencing overall a pretty good season for the dairy industry this year. There's been a significant increase in feed production, and as a result, input costs have eased, which has really improved conditions at the farm gate over the course of the year.
When we break it down state by state, New South Wales in particular has had a very favourable January period and overall a pretty good year.
That's it. So in January, milk production in New South Wales grew 4.5% compared to January the year prior. And season to date, milk production is up 1.7%, really supported by that surge in feed and especially grain production in New South Wales, as well as improved seasonal conditions from what has been a few challenging years for the industry.
And overall, what impact has it had on your forecast for milk production across Australia?
So whilst conditions at the farm gate have been quite favourable across most of the country, we had a slower milk production, less milk being produced over spring than our initial forecast would have assumed. As such, we've actually revised the milk production forecast to suggest a fairly flat outcome for the season. So our current forecast suggests -1% to +1% change to the national milk pool this year, which would equate to about 8.7 to 8.8 billion litres of milk.
You also mentioned a number of challenges that dairy farmers and the industry is facing, with continued farm exits being a problem. How significant is that, and do you have any numbers on how many people are leaving the industry?
So, yes, as I said, there's a number of reasons we haven't really seen that growth in milk production eventuate this season. A key one being that we have a smaller national dairy herd. Last financial year, we estimate that our dairy herd shrank about 8%. And as a result, it's going to take quite a while to recover those losses in cow numbers before we see production growth opportunities arise. At the same time, there's also issues around labor shortages. with the COVID-19 pandemic blocking international workers from entering Australia. With really high beef prices this year and fairly strong interest from beef and sheep farmers for buying land, there are farm exits occurring in most regions. We don't have a full year data for it yet, but we do have a suggested that there's quite a lot of farm exits still happening. Interestingly, though, this year is that farmers are quoting different reasons for choosing to exit the industry at this point compared to previous years, where this year it really seems to be driven by people wanting to try to get out of the industry when the market is at a high, tipping it's close to a peak with fairly strong demand for rural properties and farms from other agricultural industries.
Dairy Australia senior analyst Sophia Olmsted speaking there to Josh Becker. On the Country Hour, it's 10 to 1. Well, not all dairy regions are enjoying the same level of recovery. The lingering impact of the drought still has a hold on dairy farmers' finances in some regions. Hunter Valley farmer David Williams acknowledges the change in seasonal conditions is helping, but he's still recovering from that three-year drought. He says he's still playing catch-up as things got neglected during the drought because they were spending so much on irrigation and grain. He told Mike Pritchard any plans for farm expansions also doubtful as he's struggling to compete with the cashed-up Sydney and Newcastle investors who are nervous about further impacts of COVID-19.
Price is okay, but we're still recovering from the drought. In a way, there's still a bit of a money drought because it's been a catch-up. Well, like, things kind of got neglected during the drought because we're spending so much on irrigation and grain. But some things, the maintenance and replacement of machinery, and that's kind of fallen behind. And even though at the end of the month, there's still not a lot left. By the time you buy seed and fertiliser and stuff like that, it's more money would be handy. And the trouble is, if we went back into a dry patch, we wouldn't be ahead of much at all.
So how significant then for you to drain your resources and not able to maintain some of the equipment?
It's made a big difference. Like there's machinery like tractors and that we should have replaced and we've kept them going and you end up chasing your tail because you end up, they break down and then you got to spend time fixing it and it just takes time and it would be better if we could replace them. And the other problem is if you do go to replace them now is there's a shortage of machinery as well. Another few cents would help. It's like everything, you can't push it up too much, otherwise the consumers are going to suffer. It's a bit of a catch-22, but a few cents would make a big difference.
Well, you've had a good season for the pastures, and it's getting to the stage probably where you've got enough water around the place?
Yeah, now, actually, it was a bit dry last week. We're hanging out for a shower of rain. We weren't desperate, but it's just perfect now. But it's looking a bit dodgy over the next few days. They're talking about 20 to 40 mil each day here for us. And March is usually a pretty wet month, so I think it might get a bit too wet. I think the cows might end up being fed in the shed.
Are you at any stage now preparing for another drought? Do you do that in your management regime?
Yeah, we're always getting ready for the next one. If we could get a bit more money, we'd like to upgrade our irrigation so it's more efficient in actual energy use and more efficient in actually growing more grass. No, we're definitely looking ahead all the time.
The other dimension to farming at the moment is the property prices and the interest level in the property prices. Is that reflected in your region as well as elsewhere in New South Wales?
In this region, it is definitely a factor. Like, it's gotten to the stage where if you wanted to expand, you wouldn't be able to afford it. You just can't compete with the cashed-up Sydney and Newcastle buyers who are moving out here because of COVID. Well, you nearly have to put your name down with a real estate agent if you were looking for a block of ground because they're just getting snapped up. Like, there's just no for sale signs around. You know, they're just selling as soon as they come on the market.
For a farmer that wants to expand into their neighbours or by their neighbours, it's going to be a challenge.
It definitely is. It is a real challenge to try and expand. And the other problem is that it's also very tempting for people that are getting towards retirement to cash out. You know, so they said, well, you know, like, why should I keep dairying up and get a few million for my property, you know?
And is there a possibility that then property may not hold the dairy farm on?
Definitely. Like, there's been four or five dairies closed around here in the last 12 months, and none of them have gone back to dairy.
David Williams there, a Hunter Valley dairy farmer. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. You can check out that mouse story we've been talking about, the mouse plague issues we've been talking about on the program in the last couple of days. There's a story online, so check that out on the ABC News page. Also, ABC Rural, so it's on the ABC page there as well. It's coming up to 6 to 1. Just letting you know, there was an announcement made recently about an ambitious project by the Maloon Institute to rehydrate the landscape. We were talking to Gary Nairn on the program a couple of weeks ago. They were rehydrating the landscape, capturing carbon in the process and cooling the earth. And they've won a prize. They've won the Response to Climate Change Award at the 2020 Australian Sustainable Communities Awards. The initiative stage one is one element of a larger catchment project, and it has about 20 farmers working alongside each other across 20,000 hectares. They're committed to restoring natural landscapes function and also to detail a level of scientific monitoring associated with it. So they've just won the 2020 Response to Climate Change Award at the Australian Sustainable Communities Award. The Maloon Institute, and in a couple of weeks' time at the Regenerative Agriculture Conference in Albury, we'll be talking to Gary Nairn about that project as well as a range of other things. And also, we've got a few more texts about the mice. We'll try and get them shortly, but we probably should go to markets now. $60. First up to Wagga Sheep and Lambs, Leanne Dax.
24,500 lams and 7,900 sheep sold to an almost full field of export and domestic buyers. Quality was noticeably plainer across trade lamb classes, with a lot of dry, longer wool types on offer. Heavy lambs were well supplied and competition was solid throughout the sale. Trade lambs are unchanged to average 809 cents a kilogram carcass weight, medium trade 171 to 194, heavy trade 183 to 206, heavy lambs 196 to 218. They were eased $2. Lambs 26 to 30 kilos were back 5, 210 to 246. Lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight were unchanged, 234 to 285. Merino trades 152 to 215. Lambs to restock and feed at the better end, 155 to 185. Rain in the north did inspire a few more processors into the market, sheep prices lifting $7 to $20, heavy ewes 170 to 276, and trade sheep 138 to 165. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Let's go to Dubbo Cattle now and David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers are up by 300 for a yarding of 1,733. It was a mixed yarding with some outstanding high-yielding vealers and yearlings, along with a good selection of ideal feeder cattle. There was a fair line-up of grass steers and heifers and cows, and there were good numbers of Boss Indicus and Boss Indicus cross yearlings in forward condition. Young cattle of the trade were up to 20 cents dearer, with prime vealers selling to 480. Prime steer yearlings sold from 400 to 496, while the prime heifer yearlings sold from 415 to 487. Feeder steers and lightweight feeder heifers were 6 to 8 cents dearer, while the heavier feeder heifers were a little cheaper. Feeder steers sold from 382 to 476, while the feeder heifers sold from 380 to 453. Ground steers and heifers were firm to 5 cents dearer. Prime ground steers sold from 314 to 416, while the prime ground heifers sold from 330 to 410. Secondary cows were a little dearer, while the prime heavyweight cows were 2 cents cheaper. 2 and 3 score cows sold from 250 to 290, while the prime heavyweight cows sold from 291 to 317 to average 305. Heavy bulls sold to 318. This is David Monk reporting from Dubbo.
And to Yass Cattle now, Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Numbers fell to 390. The quality was good. There was a big run of heavy cows and heavy feeder steers. Light young cattle were very limited, as were the grown steers and bullocks. Not all the usual buyers were operating in a cheaper market, with price trends easing 15 cents and 20 cents on the heavier cattle. Calves sold to 705 cents a kilo, light weaner steers 490 to 512, medium weight feeder steers 440 to 460, the heavy weights 374 to 435. Medium weight feeder heifers went against the trend, holding firm 410 to 450. The heavyweights eased and sold from 355 to 427. Heavy trade cattle 376 to 385. Grown steers reached 375. Light cows to a restocking order reached 300 cents. And the heavy 3 and 4 score processing cows 285 to 310. And this has been Graham Richard at Yass.
Let's go to Armidale Cattle, Stephen Adams.
Good afternoon. Armidale reduced by 307 head for 543 on the 18th of March. There was an increase in weight in the yearling steer offering, and the balance of the penning was of mixed quality with condition mostly good. Feeder competition was strong, not many light cattle for restocker competition, and all the regular buyers attended. Bobby calves sold to 676 cents a kilo. Demand for weaner steers was strong, 570 to 656. The heifers to 518. Trade veal, 440 to 502. Yearling steers to feed sold a strong trend, medium weights 400 to 476, although the heavy feeders slipped 7 cents, 346 to 465. Restockers competitive, 340 to 458. Medium feeder heifers slipped slightly, 400 to 410. Heavy ground steers to feed dropped 10 cents to make 330 to 350 and 340 to process. Heifers to the trade, marginally cheaper to 336 cents. Medium cows significantly dearer, 255 to 289. 4 and 5 score cows were 5 cents better, 280 to 290. And heavy bulls to 286. Stephen Adams, MLA at Armidale.
Thanks for that, Stephen. That's the markets for today. And a reminder, as I said, some stories online about the mouse plagues. You can head to abc.net.au/rural or maybe on the news page. It's coming up to news time.